real fast. Ready? Good morning and welcome to the Senate Special Committee on Revenue, this Saturday session. Many bills have been assigned to our committee, many of which the members of the committee have only heard about, most of which we know have been worked on by the House. That's how we get them. But I would like to start this morning by having Paul Warner give us an overview of the bills that have been assigned to our committee and essentially what those bills accomplish, what they're designed to do, and what implications they might have for balancing our budget or creating revenue or adding to the solution that we have to find before we can close this legislative special session. My intention is to work until noon, just getting through this overview, then to take a break till about 2 p.m. and then reconvene about 2:15. In that brief interview, I will at least have an opportunity to meet with some of the leadership team and find out what their specific directions for our committee are. Then we'll reconvene at about between about 2:30 would be good, and make the decision what more business we can conduct today that will get us through this day, and hopefully we will not have to convene tomorrow. So, Paul, with that, I'll just turn it over to you, and with the greatest economy of words and pithiest statements you can make, an overview of what transpired in the House and what bills this committee has been assigned.
Considering he was probably up until the wee hours of the morning, don't ask too much here.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Chair, I think the Senate President's description of our staff as zombies is probably pretty accurate so far. I'll go through the bills on your agenda and suggest a little different order because there is a logical grouping here. And just to briefly describe them, answer any questions you have, and then when we get through that, then we have the staff measure summaries and revenue impact where appropriate, and we'll go into details where you'd like to. the first bill there is H.J.R. 80. H.J.R. 80 is a bill that is replaces the Measure 13 that failed at the polls in May. What it does is some things similar to Measure 13. It converts the Education Endowment Fund into an Education Stability Fund. It does transfer dollars from the new Stability Fund to the State School Fund this biennium. It transfers $180 million, which is a part of the rebalance plan of the House. That is done on May 1st. As you remember, Measure 13 transferred $220 million, so there's $40 million less in that package. There are a couple of other differences. The measure comes into play 30 days after it's approved by voters. Measure 13 actually set an operational date in May. So this one does have an accompanying statutory language for managing the fund. It also establishes a higher rate of transfer into the stability fund. It boosts the amount of lottery funds going in from 15% to 18%. That isn't done until July 1. So that leads to roughly $20 million more per biennium going into the stability fund than would have under Measure 13. The final piece that's different is an amendment in the House that creates a new school capital matching fund that once the fund is capped out, and it's capped out at 5% of the general fund, that diversion would go into a new school capital matching fund. So there are some definite differences there with Measure 13, but the structure in terms of the stability fund, in terms of the triggers, are the same.
Paul, just perhaps we can do a great deal of our work in this orientation. Any member of the committee have a question on this Senate Measure 13?
Just one quick thing.
Question.
Representative Shetterly, when he carried his bill on the House floor late last night, had some graphics that he was using, spreadsheets or some, yeah, there we go. I was hoping that we had that material.
We've been working with Senator Menace long enough to anticipate that question. Send back request.
Senator Crowe.
As somebody who's been on Ways and Means Committee off and on for a long time, we always seem to have not enough general fund resource to meet our needs. And by taking more money from the lottery, basically, to go into this fund, which is locked away for stability down the road, you take it away from the monies you have to use in the operation of getting to budget determination. And the question is, we already have $1 billion problem in the next biennium, not having enough money to balance the budget. So I'm just wondering if that 15% to 18% locking away money that's very much needed does make sense. At least I'll put it out there. Do we know what the impact of that is? How much money does that take away from the general fund and put into the stability fund? We have a figure?
Mr. Chair, I have a chart that simulates how the fund would grow. And we'll distribute that.
I know that. Does this tell us what the specific measure does to make it grow more and how much?
Senator Trill, I think the column that's most relevant to your concern is the one in the middle, discretionary change from current law. What you would be doing is two things, transferring $180 to the state school fund in the first biennium. That would leave a stability fund balance of $98 million. It would have been $278 without that transfer. That will reduce earnings because the fund balance goes down by, we estimate, $19 million next biennium.
Mm-hmm.
By about $500,000 this biennium. But the key number, I think, in terms of discretionary revenue that would be transferred into the fund is that middle column, discretionary change from current law, and that is about $19 million per biennium. That is the 3% differential going from 15 to 18%. Because now with the endowment fund at 15%, you've got that other 3% just used for discretionary purposes. A good deal of which has gone into the state school fund historically, but also in the economic development fund. So those dollars would no longer be discretionary. They would be committed to the stability fund.
So it's using money that's discretionary that hasn't just generally, of course, if it goes into the school fund, school support fund, that's a big part of the general fund.
Yes, Senator, the discretionary lottery, you can see there is a $391 million estimate for 0103, but that number actually falls anyway because the lottery revenue is expected to be down.
Well, why don't we get a little better figure so we have some kind of how much money this involves, that will the additional 3% going into the fund that might otherwise go into the school support fund. I mean, how many millions is that?
Senator, the middle column there with the...
Is that the millions?
Yes, those are millions of dollars, and those funds are what the legislature under current law would have available to appropriate as they wish in the lottery budget.
Mm-hmm.
Currently, we have about $200 million of that does go to the state school fund, but it goes to other purposes as well.
Yeah.
So that's the trade-off, is that $20 million per biennium would no longer be discretionary. It would go directly into the fund and could not be accessed unless the triggers to the fund are met.
Okay.
In other words, Senator Carr, I finally
understand.
The destination is the same. The lock-in provision is what's new.
Well, and the money is not available for the general fund needs in balancing a budget because it's locked into a stability fund that you can only use under certain conditions, and you can't use it for balancing the budget. So you're down another $20 million for balancing the budget, right? No? Am I wrong?
You have $20 million less in discretionary dollars that you could use under normal circumstances,
right,
i.e. non-recessionary,
right,
to balance the budget.
That's correct. Okay. That's all I want to know.
Okay.
That's true.
Unless we stay in a recession and gambling keeps going.
Yeah.
That mitigates.
Any further questions on HCR 8? If not, Mr. Warner, have you concluded your overview of what the bill is?
I have, Mr. Chair. There's a couple of bills that are related to that, and the fourth one down is House Bill 4052, which is an implementation bill. I mentioned earlier that an implementation bill did not accompany what became Measure 13 because it wasn't operational until the end of the biennium. The assumption was that would be part of a regular session bill. Now, since this does become operational, there is an accompanying bill. And basically, what this does is goes through all the statutes and converts endowment fund to stability fund, so there's consistency there. But it also gives the treasurer discretion in terms of managing the accounts and sub-accounts for the purposes of making that $180 million transfer. The key is that there is, under current statute, a 10% diversion from the endowment fund into the Oregon Growth Account. Now, that won't change under this, but the treasurer can, at his discretion, alter the amount going into that fund or the balance of that fund in order to make the $180 million transfer that's called for. Once that transfer is made, then it reverts back to current law.
So 4052 would be mechanics and process for implementation.
Yes, sir.
Questions? Proceed.
The other bill, and I apologize for skipping around, but the other bill is related to this package, is House Bill 4056. What that does is, if you look at the budget, omnibus budget bill, which is not part of your agenda, part of the Budget Reconciliation Committee, but that bill has a $180 million disappropriation from the state school fund.
Mm-hmm.
Just as we did under the Measure 13 process in the last special session. But if that, if the new measure, HGR 80, is to fail, the $180 million disappropriation still stands.
Mm-hmm.
So what House Bill 4056 attempts to do is come into play if HGR 80 fails, and it authorizes the state treasurer to issue revenue bonds that are paid from the master settlement agreement.
Right. So this basically is the plan B in the event that HJR 80 fails.
That's correct.
And it would account for the $180 million disappropriation.
Yes, it would backfill the 180. It is modeled after Senate Bill 832, which came before your committee in the regular session, which set up a process for OHSU to issue revenue bonds.
Okay.
And backed by the master settlement.
Can I ask a question?
Questions, Senator?
Help me understand. I'm not sure this disappropriation. We had a disappropriation in the second special session of $200 million, correct?
Correct.
We have another disappropriation of $180
million? Senator, that's correct. In order to use this $180 toward the gap itself, what we're doing is we're saying we're going to take this $180
I see.
And replace the general fund with it in order to help fill the gap.
Understand.
On the 200 disappropriation that you currently have from the second special session, that is basically being filled with Senate Bill 1022, which came out of your committee on the retiming.
Which is the timing issue.
Okay, all right.
The fourth bill that's in this series is the last one there, which is House Bill 4059, and that is the special election bill. And it applies not only to HGR 80, but also to House Bill 4051. So that sets up a September 17 special election. The rationale there for a September ballot special election rather than November election is to give the districts some time to plan, some certainty in their budget process, and also in terms of the cigarette tax, to make it clear whether the tax that's being imposed on July 1 indeed is confirmed by the voters. So that package of four goes together and is related indirectly to the stability fund. The other parts of your agenda House Bill 4050, is an extension of the 911 Emergency Communications Act. There is a sunset in current law in 2004. This would extend it out to 2007. And, so that's a straight extension of current law. House Bill 4051, increases the cigarette tax, by 75 cents, from 68 cents to $1.43. It is, referred to the voters in the September 17, election. We estimate that that will generate a net increase to the state of $107 million this biennium. That's based on the assumption that the 75 cent increase will be applied to cigarettes purchased on or after July 1, and will be reflected in filing done by wholesalers and retailers after the effective date of the measure.
Can we meet the time deadlines for that? The House has acted. Is that sufficient to meet the time deadlines, or does the Senate have to act and in order to ensure that $107 million is the amount?
Senator, there's the issue in terms of timing is that we have been making those estimates based on a July 1 begin collecting at the higher revenue rate on July 1. The Department of Revenue does need about 2 weeks, roughly. I know there's not a precise day, but they have asked for 2 weeks in order to inform distributors and retailers, many of which are small, many of which are outside the state, of this increase, which will be effective July 1 in terms of their sale of their cigarettes. So they've got to make pricing decisions as to how they're going to respond to that. And so the Revenue Department has requested that amount of time so that they can carry out that function. For retailers, obviously that's a key decision as to how their prices are going to change to reflect a higher rate of tax. So that's the reason behind the 2 weeks.
We had been told sort of that if all this didn't happen by Friday, that somehow or other we would have missed the time deadline, but we still have some time to get this thing passed without reducing the amount.
Well, the time is, I don't think there's necessarily a drop-dead date, but we're certainly within that two-week interval right now. We're getting very close to it. Monday would be exactly the two-week interval. So we can have the Department of Revenue comment on that. They're here in the audience.
So far, you're showing it at $107 million.
We're showing it at $107 and assuming that July 1 starts.
Other questions?
The other measures there that are part of your agenda, House Bill 4054. House Bill 4054 modifies Measure 88, which was approved by voters in the November 2000 general election. What that measure did was, beginning with the 2002 tax years, bump up the maximum allowable subtraction of federal taxes from your state return from $3,000 to $5,000. What this would do is phase in an increase to $5,000 over a four-year period. For the 2002 and 2003 tax years, the maximum allowable subtraction would be $3,250 for the current year and $3,500 for 2003 tax year. Compared to current law, this measure increases general fund revenue by $108 million. This is, of course, a three-fifths vote, as was the House Bill 4051.
That's $108 million this biennium?
$108 million this biennium. It also increases general fund revenue by $119 million next biennium because of the phase-in over a four-year period. So you'd have a lower subtraction cap in 03 and 04 than you do under current law.
So phasing it in does help the next biennium by 119?
By 119 as House Bill 4054 passed the House.
Okay. Senator Duncan.
Madam Chair.
Welcome.
I guess a question I'd ask Paul is, as I understand it, what's the maximum amount that anyone
would benefit by, well, I guess that's with the 5,000, would be $184 in a year.
Senator Duncan, it's 180 because it's, you know, the highest rate is 9%. So if you're increasing your subtraction from 3,000 to 5,000, you're increasing it by 2,000, so it'd just be 2,000 times 9%. Would be $180. That's for a joint or single file.
So that's the maximum anyone would benefit.
The maximum possible benefit, arithmetically, is $180.
Chair, that's at 5,000.
That would be to go from 3 to 5 right now. Mm-hmm. So you would scale down from there under this proposal.
Okay.
So under going to the 3,500 in 03, for example, the maximum you could have would be $45.
The maximum anyone would be
gaining from the 3,000 would be $45.
$45.
So instead of gaining costing 180, someone, you're gaining 45.
Right. Or it's costing someone 45, but you have to be at a...
No, it's not costing you. If you look at where we were compared to 01, current law will gain you 180.
Mm-hmm.
This, in 03, would only gain you 45.
Right.
The 45 yeah. versus 180.
Right.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. Also a good dinner.
the last measure on the agenda there is House Bill 4058. This bill directs the Division of State Lands to distribute a minimum of 5% of the value of the Common School Fund for a 3-year period, beginning with the upcoming fiscal year. Right now, there is quite a bit of confusion over the State Land Board's authority to distribute based on some opinions from the Attorney General as to what constitutes principal and how earnings can be distributed. But what this bill does is directs a minimum of 5%. We know what the value of the Common School Fund is as of January 1, 2002, which would be applied to the first year. That's $724 million. That would lead to a distribution of about $37 million for the 5%. Currently, in our assumptions about local revenue for schools, we're assuming $15 million for 02-03. So it's an increase of $22 million from current law, and given the change we've had in the local revenue forecast for schools, it just about offsets the decrease we've had since the close of session. So, and it is a local revenue source, so you can think of it that way as an offset to the lower than projected property tax collections since last year. Well, and that would sunset after a 3-year period.
Well, what authority do we have to statutorily direct the votes of independent elected officials?
Senator, I'd like to refer that to counsel.
I see Cindy.
Cindy's here.
Cindy Hunt, Legislative Counsel's Office. Senator Dukes, I believe the question was how much authority we have to direct
the votes. I mean, we're telling the State Land Board they have to do something, and they have to vote to do that. So,
mm-hmm. Senator Dukes, actually in the bill we're telling the Division of State Lands to distribute.
Oh, we're just going to run over the school board. Okay? Guess that works.
Actually, also what this triggers off of is current statutes that direct the State Land Board and the Division of State Lands to take earnings from the Common School Fund and put them in the distributable income account that's mentioned in this bill. And that's consistent with the constitutional provisions around the Common School Fund talking about earnings being used for schools. So as far as authority to direct the Division of State Lands to do the actions under this bill, the Constitution allows us to do that.
We already have a statute that says you transfer this amount. We're just going to change the...
What we have is a statute that says that the Division of State Lands will deposit earnings from a variety of sources that are in the Common School Fund. Some are interest earnings, some are dividend earnings, some are profits from equity investments into the income account. A couple of the earning types we allow discretion to the Division of State Lands about how many, how, what proportion of those earnings go into the distributable income account. In this bill, basically what we're doing is we're limiting that discretion for 3 years.
Mr. Chair, if the earnings don't amount up to the $37 million, what then? They do, though. They're always much bigger than that. Is that the case?
I'm going to let Paul answer that, because I think he looked at the numbers a little more than I have.
Senator, I think this gets at the heart of the confusion over just how much discretion the State Land Board has in the current law. The practice has been to base earnings, really to measure earnings as a change in the value of the fund.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do that and take that literally, that means that there are years, for example, the previous year, which there could be none distributed because the value of the fund has declined.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can't use any principal, then if there's no earnings, then there would be nothing available for distribution. Current State Land Board policy is a minimum 2% distribution. So there is quite a bit of uncertainty around how you interpret earnings, and that process probably needs some thorough review. You can interpret earnings in a number of ways. It could be earnings over some period of time. It could be earnings over the sale of assets. The board now has a very high proportion of the portfolio in equities, so there are earnings technically every time they sell one of those equities.
Mm-hmm.
So there is, I guess the simple answer, Senator, is that there isn't a lot of uncertainty over that issue. And that really came up with some of the earlier bills you looked at on the Common School Fund from the first special session and the opinions that we've gotten from AG and from the council, from Legislative Council, on what constitutes earnings.
Right. Well, as you just read the description of the bill, it talks about the value of the fund. It doesn't say anything about earnings. It just talks about the value. And they're going to distribute at least 5% of the value every year. Or is that every biennium?
Senator Trow, one of the reasons we plugged in the January 1 date and the term value of the fund, because that matches current State Land Board policy, the wording in the policy and the date that triggers for them.
Okay.
And we weren't desiring to change that policy, I mean the wording that they use, the value, and the date that they use to determine that value.
But conceivably they would have no earnings, but you would go into the principal then or something to give the minimum 5%.
Actually, what they would do is, like Paul was saying, that they do have some equity investments that perhaps they could sell, and therefore getting the earnings from those equity investments, so it's not really going into the principal.
It would force them to get additional earnings.
Yeah.
Okay. It would force them to liquidate assets in order to make that distribution.
Yeah. Okay.
By the way, to give you some sense of expectations on the earnings of the fund, the Division of State Lands is projecting about a 7.3% long-term growth on the value of the fund. So that's their 5-year projection.
Just passed out all the bills.
And in only 22 minutes.
Good.
All right. All of these bills that we have today were scheduled for public hearing, possible work session. We put out sign-up sheets for all of the bills that are on the agenda, so I'd ask the staff to see if anyone has signed up for testimony on any of these bills. We also scheduled Senate Bill 1021 for work session, possible today, although I'm certain that we wouldn't have any changes or work session on that till after 2:30, so... again, it's the chair's intention to recess this committee at 12 and then reconvene it at 2:30. On Senate Bill 4051, we have several folks that wanted to express some interest in that bill and offer testimony. on Senate Bill 4058, we have just one person who wants to make clarification. So what we'll do is go into a public hearing on Senate Bill 4058, and we'll ask Jeanette Holman from Division of State Lands to come forward. Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you today?
Well, like everybody. Thank you for taking this first. I appreciate it.
Yes, ma'am.
For the record, Jeanette Holman from the Division of State Lands. I'm coming to relay concerns about this bill from the division. We are scrambling right now to produce enough distributable earnings on investments to make a 2% distribution in June. Our concern is that raising that to 5% would make it difficult, if not impossible, to meet and put us up against a constitutional problem as far as doing something that, according to our Attorney General's advice, is not allowed. So what we're, the land board has been talking about changes to even out the distribution formula that they use at this point, and hopefully we'll do that. That may not address giving more money this biennium, however. So I just raising those concerns that we might not have 5% to distribute in December and June of 2000 and even next biennium unless we have a good turnaround in the market.
Okay, let's just speculate that somewhere in the building, lawmakers suggested as part of the solution, let's just direct the state land board to produce more income, because in fact they manage significant land holdings, forestry holdings, and also manage a portfolio of stocks that are derived from the sale of forfeited property or abandoned property or unclaimed funds. And although it seems like a reasonable approach to just simply direct a higher output from those funds, you say there's a constitutional problem and there may be a performance problem. Could you be more specific about the constitutional problem?
According to the advice we received from the Attorney General, we can not dip into the corpus of the Common School Fund to make a distribution. Once earnings on investments have been put back in and reinvested into the corpus of the fund, they become a part of the corpus, and we can't distribute those because the trust fund nature of the Common School Fund requires us to distribute only the earnings on it.
Okay. So that would detail the constitutional problem. It's a question of violation of the public trust doctrine and some other issues about the fiduciary responsibility that the agency has not to diminish its trust or harm the trust by using the corpus of the funds.
Under trust law, you have to protect the corpus of the trust for the future, and that plays into the whole discussion of what we can distribute as well as what the statute and constitution.
So that might constitute waste of the estate.
That's exactly right.
Okay. Senator Crowe has a question.
When you're talking about dipping into the principal, I understand the principal of there's two major categories of money in that's considered the principal, and one of them dates back to when it was the board was established to take care of problems. The other is monies that are there because of actions of the legislature. Is there any difference between the two categories of money in the fund?
Mr. Chair, Senator Trout, yes, there are. There's actually three categories of funds within the Common School Fund. One is the constitutional corpus, one is the statutory part of the corpus, and one is the unclaimed property deposit liability, and they're all put into the fund together, and we earn interest on all parts of them. The statutory portion of the fund is about $17 million. The unclaimed property deposit liability is about $120, but we've been told by the AG that that part of the money is not the state of Oregon's money because we hold it for those people who have unclaimed property. And while we are told we can borrow money from there, we have also been told that we need to pay it back or change the statute to, you know, allow only a certain period of time before it is cheated to the state. And the statutory portion of money, according to the AG, we have more flexibility with that money, but it's never been enough to fix any big problems. So we haven't discussed that as far with the Attorney General as...
Were you able to give advice to the committee last night when they considered this provision?
I did not testify last night.
So it's the first time this information about the problem has come forward.
As far as I know, I don't know what Paul has told people.
Thank you, Senator. The $120 million, in fact, is subject to unadjudicated claims.
That's correct.
And we can borrow, but we have to repay with interest, do we not?
My understanding is we have to repay, but it's there's some question whether we have to pay interest.
And you indicated in your testimony that the agency's been aware of this issue and the desire for more distributions from the fund. Has the agency itself come up with any approach to dealing with either the constitutional question or the desire for more allocations from the fund?
During the first special session, when we got the opinions from the Attorney General, we started discussions with the land board about looking at our current distribution formula and whether we could make the distributions we wanted to as far as under that current formula. And it didn't appear we could, that the same restraints that are on the legislature are also on the land board. So what they have directed us to do is to propose legislation to try to set up some sort of process to at least, like I said, even out the distributions or set aside some money so it isn't captured into the corpus from the earnings.
Okay. And was it your intention or the agency's intention to bring forth a legislative proposal in 2003 in the regular session?
That's correct.
Okay. Would there be a possibility of the agency presenting amendment to House Bill 4058 that would accomplish these goals?
I'd have to talk to our land board and to the director before I could commit to that.
Okay. But at least it would be potential, and that is something that might inform this bill or make it more effective.
Yeah.
Do we have an idea? I mean, this bill before us basically just makes a suggestion on a percentage. Do we have an idea of the fiscal impact of the percentages? Can you give me a comparison, or is there a comparison available?
Mr. Chair, you're talking about in terms of the amount that would be distributed under a 5% rule.
Yeah, as
our current assumption.
Exactly right.
The bill refers to the value of the fund as of January 1, so it would be a distribution for the coming school year would be as 5% of $724 million. That would be
done.
that would be a distribution of about $37 million. And right now we're assuming $15 million distributed from the common school fund for this coming school year. So in net increase of about $20 million.
In point of fact, isn't it more than double the output then?
Yeah.
It would more than double the assumption used now for the local revenue estimate. Well, one thing I might add, Mr. Chair, in terms of how this fits in with the House discussion is the House is very aware of this issue because this idea has been talked about for quite a while and within the House Revenue Committee in particular. But the gap, as you recall, that you looked at on Wednesday, was $859 million.
What the House did was add 20 to that gap to make it 879 so that they could increase the buyback to the schools and reduce the $112 million reduction that's embedded in that 859 gap. So the $20 million would be used to enhance the basic gap. So there's a recognition that this that these monies could not be counted against the $859 million gap.
Okay, but in point of fact, in the future,
well,
I think that may be the impetus here. I see that it, I don't want to refer to the to actions taken by the other body, but those that are aware enough to count votes see that it had quite enthusiastic support, at least in some quarters of this.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Trow.
As someone who's served on the Ways and Means Committee a lot, and we've looked at the amount of money that's come into education as education has needed money from the Common School Fund, we've been generally disappointed about the total amount. It seems like that there are a lot of expenses that you pay with the income and other kinds of things, and the amount that actually gets into education has not been as much as I think it's possible to get there. And so I hope you're looking at that, because the purpose of the fund is to help education. Education's in trouble, and I don't know that you've been helping that much.
Mr. Chair, Senator Trow, just a comment on that is that, yeah, we have been looking at it, and one of the concerns expressed by the land board is that the way the formula is set up now, we help schools when they don't need it, and we hurt them when they do need it. And
so what are you doing to change that?
That's what the proposed legislation is trying to get at. It's a discussion. The other thing the agency is doing is looking at trying to be more aggressive in managing the assets of the Common School Fund, both the investment assets as well as some of the Common School Fund lands and those kinds of investments.
Now, administrative expenses come out of the earnings?
The expenses of the division, all of the expenses of the division, which is about $11.6 million, come out of the revenue from the earning, you know, from like the land investments and stuff like that. Not the investment earnings all go into the distributable income account.
Okay. Well, anyway, I think there's a problem, and I hope we can get at it.
Senator Trow, but I think we have two clear choices here. We can ask the agency to, or at least we can ask Ms. Holman to check with her land board members to see if we can bring forward those amendments, or we can look at the accountability question that you brought up and refer it to Senator Yee's subcommittee on accountability in the audit committee. And so we do have some options here. Questions from the committee. Then I would urge Ms. Holman to get back to us with an answer about whether or not we can look at the agency's approach in concept, if that legislative proposal hasn't matured enough to be brought forward as amendments, at least in concept. If there's any other person here present that wishes to speak to House Bill 4058, that should come forward. Thank you, ma'am. Hearing and seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 4058. House Bill 4051. Mr. Warner, if you could just remind the committee of the purpose and scope of House Bill 4051 before we open a public hearing. We have several folks that would like to comment on the issue.
I'm going to get Mr. Yates.
Mr. Yates, please come forward. See that grimace?
Morning, Chair.
Morning, Mr. Yates. Well, let's open the public hearing on House Bill 4051, and if you would provide the committee with a brief overview of the bill.
For the record, Richard Yates with Legislative Revenue Office. The bill increases the cigarette taxes effective January 1, 2003, with a sunset of January 1, 2008. The increase is 75 cents per pack, expressed in the bill 37.5 mils per cigarette, $2.75 per pack. It dedicates this revenue with 1.6% divided essentially between the local government users of cigarette tax, which is the cities and counties, and the senior and disabled transit, and the remaining 98.4% going to the a new fund which the bill establishes, which is called the Oregon Health Plan Fund. Now, as I said, this takes effect January 1, 2003. The next two sections of the bill impose retroactively this same tax increase beginning July 1 of this year. That will create a liability for the wholesalers. The tax, cigarette tax is imposed on wholesalers. And that tax liability for months, the bill will become effective. It referred to the people, and it will become effective 30 days after the September 17th election. And so the first part of the bill, as I say, is becomes effective January 1 of 2003. And the reason I'm saying that is because that's the first calendar quarter after the effective date of the bill, and that's the language of the bill. So anyway, for the months of July, August, September, and through December, wholesalers will accrue a liability, 75 cents per pack distributed. They will then file with the department by January 20th and make payment of that liability.
Interesting approach. And Mr. Yates, I realize we're not talking to council here, but wouldn't that be considered at least a questionable practice in terms, would that not be considered a flooring tax or a liability created ex post facto? Or?
Well, it's not uncommon. You've done that before. In 95, the 10-cent temporary tax, which is dedicated to the health plan, sunsetted. During that session, the legislature passed an increase. The effective date of that bill was in October. And so the payments for July, August, and September were actually made, maybe October, were made in November. The liability accrued for those months during that period, and the wholesalers then settled with the Department of Revenue in November after the effective date of the act. And you do it, have done it a number of times also with respect to income tax. In other words, during a regular session, if you were to increase the income tax rates, in general, you make those effective as of the first day of the calendar year that you're in. So you will have passed an increase which might become effective in October, but it applies back to January 1 of that year. So it's the same sort of thing.
Wow. And yes, Senator Dukes has a question.
But in this case, if we do it ourselves, if we were just to implement a cigarette tax and say, and move it back, I guess that's one thing. But in this case, we're putting it on the ballot. Is that right for the public?
It does contain a referral.
And so, isn't that unusual? So basically the people would be saying in September that they wanted folks to start paying the prior July?
July 1st, yes.
Prior months July. Before they actually, so the people would be reaching back in time.
That's true.
And if the, I suppose we could speculate endlessly on the prospects of passage of this resolution, but referral, but if it is rejected, what happens to these dollars that are collected in anticipation of the tax?
There is nothing collected.
It's an ongoing liability.
The liability disappears. What I would imagine, what happens here is you've got a market where people behave in whatever way is their best interest. But what I would imagine is that the wholesalers are going to increase the price and put that money into some sort of fund so that they can meet their liability in January. If that liability goes away by the defeat of this bill at the polls, the money's there.
And is there a companion provision to add a bridge tolls between Oregon and Idaho.
Look, nothing to bet here.
There are several people who signed up to make testimony on the bill. Have we finished with the overview, or should we talk about the potential revenue? Let's talk about the rate of taxation and the potential revenue generated.
The rate of taxation is basically the 75-cent increase. That takes you to $1.43. Neighbors, California, or excuse me, Washington, currently 142.5, so basically you have the same rate.
But we would be at 143.
Yes.
So we would be number one.
The way we figure that, Oregon does not have a sales tax, but you're actually talking about the price of buying the pack of cigarettes. Washington still is actually higher, because in general you've got a 7 or 8% sales tax.
On top of that?
Yes.
Okay. So that's not bigger. And what would the revenue drive from that 75-cent position look like?
For the current biennium, you've got $113 million, which is flowing into the health plan. A little bit, $3 million more goes in, but the bill also calls for a transfer of $5 million from the health plan fund into the tobacco use reduction account. So the tobacco use reduction account gets a small increase as a result of this, about $2.1 million. The general fund is down $6.3 million because of the interaction between, hopefully, some intended purposes of this is to reduce smoking.
So the elasticity effect would be a reduction to the general fund?
Yes.
Okay.
The net overall impact then for the current biennium is $107 million. For the next biennium, it's $248 million.
Okay. So general fund reductions overall, but health plan increases significant.
Yes.
And tobacco use reduction account pretty much is reduced somewhat. Over time,
yes. The transfer that I referred to is a one-time transfer, so that gives them additional revenue for the current biennium, but thereafter the revenues are reduced.
Okay. Let's bring questions from the committee, if there are any at this point, and then if not, yes, Senator Duke.
A technical question. Dick, on page 3, line 19, is that July 1st, 2001 supposed to be July 1st, 2002? It's the money transferred from the Oregon Health Plan Fund to the Tobacco Use Reduction Account.
Line 19, did you say?
Yes.
It's 3, line 19. Committee chair accepts that as a yes. There's a problem with that.
Sorry, I don't have an A engrossed copy. So
there you are, sir. Line 19, page 3. Date is 2001, July 1st. So it would be retroactive to the first day of the new biennium.
The biennium begins...
Well, we're into 2002 now, and neither one of these funds existed in 2001. So I was just curious if it would be actually possible to transfer money between them in a year in which they didn't exist.
Well,
maybe
only if the retroactive tax is enacted.
This is just a reference to
virtual money.
There you go.
This is just a reference to identify that the transfer occurs during the current biennium, which is the biennium
beginning.
Okay.
So it's
okay.
Yes.
Okay. Senator Duke, thank you for
not being able to read well.
No, pursuing what looked like an almost day. Any further questions?
We had a couple of those yesterday.
Yeah. So we heard that there may be some scrambled eggs in this time that were unintended. So, and I think that speaks to the issue that the president discussed this morning in the Senate session, which is we really do appreciate the fact that legislative fiscal revenue and our legislative council drafting staff had to work and are working long hours to get through this special session.
Now, one last thing, if I may, Mr. Chair, there are provisions in Section 8 of the bill which increase the compensation to distributors for affixing stamps to the cigarette.
Mm-hmm.
The distributors actually have to open up the cartons and place the stamps on each pack of cigarettes and then close the cartons back up. Mm-hmm. Current law has a graduated pat or discount with 24 one hundredths of a cent per stamp. That's for a 20 cigarette pack, allowed on the first 26,000 cases and then 0.4% thereafter. What the bill does is just make it uniform 0.4%
for all.
Per stamp.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Yates? Hearing and seeing none, we'll open the public hearing on House Bill 4051, and we'll call Maura Roche from the Heart, Lung, and Cancer Coalition. Welcome.
No way. I'd rather spend a Saturday.
Okay.
No better way, did I hear you say?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Maura Roche, and I represent the Tobacco-Free Coalition of Oregon, which is made up of the American Heart Association, the American Lung Association, and the American Cancer Society. With me today, actually, is Nancy Bennett from the American Cancer Society. And I just thought I would do two things today. I know there has been some discussion about the amount of money that would be saved in terms of the increase in saved lives and health costs to the state of Oregon by increasing the tobacco tax. So I'm going to address that. And then when we saw this bill on the other side, there were a number of issues raised around how this impacts consumption and smuggling and gray label and black market, et cetera. So I'm going to go over that in the second part of my testimony. Excuse me. Raising the cigarette tax by 75 cents a pack would help deter children from starting to smoke. It would also provide a cost savings to health programs, as some smokers will quit due to the increased purchase price. In addition to providing much-needed revenue for the increase, and much-needed revenue for the state, the 75-cent tobacco tax would save additional lives and money for Oregon. We hope the committee would consider allocating the tax in a manner consistent with Measure 44, which many of you may recall was the voter-approved ballot measure that increased the tobacco tax back in 1996. That measure allocated a small portion of the tax to the Tobacco Prevention Program, which is the program that we have today, and the rest of the proceeds went to the Oregon Health Plan. The Department of Human Resources estimates that allocating, say, 7.5% of a 75-cent tax to the state's successful tobacco prevention and education program, combined with the natural suppression effect that occurs when you increase the tax, would lead to an additional 2,400 lives saved and $600 million saved in Oregon's future health care costs. According to DHS, Oregon annually loses $1.76 billion in taxpayer medical services, private medical expenses, and lost productivity from early death. A 75-cent cigarette tax increase dedicated to health care is the right approach as you try to solve some of the financial problems facing Oregon while helping reduce tobacco use in the future. A cigarette tax increase is also popular with the public and will help the state solve some of its revenue problems. Just this past November, 65% of voters in Washington state favored a 60-cent tax increase on tobacco. Polling indicates that Oregonians would favor an increase in the tobacco tax, provided it is used for purposes related to tobacco prevention and tobacco-induced health care services. The state of Oregon provides both of these in the form of the Tobacco Prevention and Education Program at DHS and in the form of subsidized health care via the Oregon Health Plan, and long-term care for seniors, many of whom in both populations suffer from tobacco-related diseases. In addition to that, there has been some discussion about whether or not consumption does in fact decrease as a result of cigarette taxes. There have been numerous scientific peer-reviewed, independently conducted studies that have demonstrated over the years that increasing the price of cigarettes does in fact decrease consumption, and those are footnoted for you in this testimony I've handed out. Additionally, every 10% increase in the price decreases smoking in pregnant women by 7%, in teenagers who start smoking by 3 to 10%, and in adults by 3 to 5%. And, of course, the best messenger of how the price affects consumption is, in fact, the tobacco industry itself. And I've got some quotes that have been pulled out of internal tobacco industry documents that show that the tobacco industry is well aware that, in fact, consumption does decrease as a result of cigarette taxes increasing. Increasing the cigarette tax, some have claimed, will lead to smuggling, internet sales, Indian reservation sales, gray market, et cetera. Regular surveys done by the Department of Human Services in Oregon indicates that less than 1% of cigarettes are purchased over the internet, which I know has been a concern that's been raised. And both Washington and California have higher cigarette taxes than Oregon. So, in fact, we are sort of inviting that behavior because we are sandwiched between the two states and have a far lower tax than either of those two.
Ms. Roach?
Yeah.
We have the written book.
Okay.
If you could summarize.
Sure, I'm happy to. There's also been some concern that increasing the cigarette tax doesn't raise revenue. Obviously, you have had the elasticity issue reviewed by legislative revenue, and you know that it does. With that, we'd be happy to answer any questions.
And maybe we have the testimony of the other panelists and then ask
I'm really here to just answer any questions, so I do not have any formal testimony.
Then let's go to questions from the committee. Ask Senator Clay.
What's the trend nationally in terms of raising the cigarette tax? Is it happening other places?
It is very much. I actually have a...
Ma'am, could you...
I'm sorry. For the record, my name is Nancy Bennett with the American Cancer Society.
Thank
and
you,
Mr. Chairman, Senator Trow. If you can see this map, this just... And I'd be happy to make copies and share this with the committee, but this will just sort of show you. These are some of the proposals that are on the table this year, and in fact, already just... Literally every week another state passes a tax increase, and what's interesting is even a state like New York that went passed a tax last year, then raised it again, and this is a bipartisan Republican governor who said clearly this is something that they needed to do. Connecticut recently passed a tax, Illinois, Vermont, and Rhode Island also recently did, so it's very much a trend nationwide.
Thank you.
Further questions from the committee? I thank you for being here today on Saturday and appreciate your testimony. Thank you. I would like to bring up Kevin Earls.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Kevin Earls, representing the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, and I'm just going to do a very brief, for the record, statement. Thank you. I have some written testimony, which I'll provide. But on behalf of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems Board of Directors and the 62 community and public hospitals around Oregon, we want to indicate our support for a tobacco tax referral to Oregon voters for their approval. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions, but provide my written testimony.
Thank you. Appreciate it, Mr. Ross. Any questions from the committee? Colleagues, it is noon. We have at least three other witnesses that wish to offer testimony on House Bill 4051. We're going to recess the committee until 2:30 when we will reopen our public hearing on House Bill 4051. Following that, we will address House Bill 4054 and House Joint Resolution 80, and colleagues, we also have a work session scheduled for Senate Bill 1021. So enjoy lunch. We'll be back here at 2:30, and we are recessed until 2:30 this afternoon.